Good morning. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. In the early 70s, when I lived in Madison, I was one of the first people in the collective that started Willie Street. To be accurate, a group of people had opened the store and worked hard to get it going, and then there was some shifting around. People came and left pretty quickly after it got opening, and I was one of the people that came in and was running it in the beginning. We worked very hard. We had long meetings. We probably worked 80 hours a week. In the little spare time we had, though, there was a real trend of becoming interested in the natural world, and word among us spread quickly that going out on field trips at the Arboretum with Jim Zimmerman, the naturalist there, was very fun, enlightening, and definitely not to be missed. He was regarded as almost a magical character. But I did miss this opportunity. It's something that I've always regretted. I do know one of my co-workers at Willie Street, Melissa, has spent her entire life as a field biologist, and I'm sure she would give Jim Zimmerman great credit for her start in loving the natural world. Today I'm going to read Sumner Madison's chapter in his book, A Field, about Jim Zimmerman. I'll be reading parts of the chapter. It's Jim here on the cover of the book, in fact. The chapter has extensive interviews that Sumner conducted with Jim in 1981 and 82. I find his stories about his childhood, his thoughts on children and how they learn, and how to teach compelling. This book gives all of us a chance to get to know this remarkable person. We start with Sumner's introduction to the Jim Zimmerman chapter. James Hall Zimmerman was an unusual and brilliant naturalist who influenced several of the naturalists featured in this book. Jim grew up and resided all of his life in an ivory-covered, gray hollow tile house on the near west side of Madison. He graduated from Wisconsin High School in 1943 and the University of Wisconsin-Madison with degrees in botany, a bachelor's in 1947, a master's in 1952, and a Ph.D. in 1958. He specialized in plant taxonomy. From 1959 to 61, he wrote college biology study guides for the United States Armed Forces Institute in Madison. Also in 1959, Jim began a six-year association with the Madison Public Schools as naturalist at the Madison School Forest. He taught ecology and prepared and evaluated outdoor education materials. Beginning in 1961, he developed a popular vocational course called Reading the Landscape, which he taught winter evenings at Madison Area Technical College until 1971. From 1965 to 76, Jim worked as a naturalist and consultant for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. During this time, he helped develop a master plan for restoring the Arboretum's 30 biotic communities. Working with his wife, Elizabeth Libby, a wildlife artist and naturalist, and with the graduate student, Barbara Bedford, he directed a comprehensive survey of Dane County wetlands, which resulted in the 1974 publication of The Wetlands of Dane County, Wisconsin. In 1977, he became a lecturer at the Department of Landscape Architecture with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Here he taught about the natural history, ecology, and management of Wisconsin's grasslands, forests, and wetlands. His course, Understanding Wetlands, earned consistent praise from undergraduate and graduate students. Friends and colleagues knew Jim as a complex and highly talented individual who, if he had a particular fault, often stretched himself thin over too many subject areas, botany, ecology, ornithology, entomology, phenology, wetland dynamics, environmental problem solving, and the restoration and management of woodlands, grasslands, and wetlands. The principal interview with Jim occurred at his home on a relatively mild night in late January 1981, and the second during a field trip in late March 1982. A small man with dark hair, a prominent forehead, and thick glasses, He proved loquacious, at times animated, and began in January by focusing on a difficult childhood and the formative influence of his mother. Now we hear Jim's voice. When I was an infant, Mother placed me outside in a baby carriage for hours each day, so I grew accustomed to fresh air and solitude. Later, she saw that I had an interest in nature, and especially in plants. I had a garden when I was 8. All through my youth, I biked everywhere. I stopped and looked at plants or listened to birds. I had a natural environment at hand all the time. Until World War II changed Madison radically, the city was quiet, and many places were a nature paradise. There was an area 4 blocks west of home that was later developed. It had all the prairies and woodlands that you could imagine. The neighborhoods were unusual around here. We had all the forest birds, and until the 1940s there was almost never the sound of a motor car. Something unusual happened when I was in 6th grade. A combination of difficulties came to a head. I think my parents weren't getting along too well at the time. Had my father not died shortly after, I probably would have witnessed a divorce. There was a strain because my father wasn't bringing in any money and he wasn't too well either. All kinds of problems. On top of that, I wasn't doing too well in school because I was like my father and, in a sense, like my mother. I listened to a different drummer. I didn't do well in school because they made you do things, physical education, math tests, and so on. If I did things differently, I wasn't understood. I was penalized, received bad marks, or sent home. To top it off, my 6th grade teacher at Randall School was a librarian who substituted for a biology teacher that the school lost, so she had to teach biology. The only thing she knew how to do was to have you read books, so we didn't look at a single plant or animal in that class. We did book reviews and book reports. Because I was a slow reader, anyway, this was the last straw. I'd come home in tears, not being able to finish my assignments. Mother finally decided to take me out of school over my father's objections. She was the kind of person who did things her own way. She said, "Let's let Jim have his gardening for a year or two and let him straighten out his problems." Well, gardening and fresh air were my salvation. As long as I was outside, I was healthy and happy. I just took off and had the greatest time. I was actually out of school for 3 years, 6th, 7th, and 8th grades. The truant officer kept coming around, and Mother had to convince him that I was making progress. The school tolerated this breach of the system, but of course, any person who succeeds while operating outside society's institutions is a threat to all institutions. The other kids in the neighborhood wondered why I could be out of school and they couldn't. I had even fewer friends after that. It was a bad situation. I'd get taunted. There were all kinds of grumblings going on. Then I went back after a summer of tutoring, and in one summer I caught up to the rest of the kids my age. Fortunately, instead of sending me to West High next door, which was a big school, my parents sent me to Wisconsin High School, a small university experimental school. I entered as a freshman, did fine, and had a great time. It took me a long time to do well in front of an audience. I was shy and frightened. It took many years to develop my own system, my own synthesis. I think whatever success I've had in reaching audiences is due to an extreme sensitivity to how other people feel. What I do is prepare in advance, but not until a few hours before a talk. Then I can remember it for a few hours without referring to notes, and it comes out fresh and natural. If I prepare too far ahead, I forget it. If I try to look at notes, it's cold and doesn't make any sense to me anymore. I'm one of those people, like my father, who does things differently each time and doesn't stick with a thing very long. This makes it difficult to teach the second section of a college class the same way as I did the first. I'll rework the material in a new way. Probably the most important thing a teacher has is personality. You've also got to be committed, well-informed, authoritative, and correct most of the time. If you're not, kids, particularly high schoolers, pick up on this fast. One strategy for reaching them is to show them you're relaxed and to let them discover nature for themselves. Kids are interested in everything, especially little things that they see on the ground. You don't work with birds very much because the amateur or novice has to be trained to see birds. I had to train myself to see birds. You start with something they all can see. Show them some plants. Tell stories about them. And soon they say, "Oh, gee, I thought those were just weeds out there." I discovered that a weed in most people's vocabulary was a plant that was unfamiliar. So I pick a few plants, tell about them, and people get all excited about them. Many people in my field classes remember that while they were studying botany in the arboretum, I would stop and point out an indigo bunting or some such bird singing overhead. Very often students were unaware of this bird singing right over us, and they had to shift gears from plants to birds. That's not easy for most people. When we took kids out to the school forest in buses, it was very important to go on the buses with them. Whether high school or grade school, it didn't matter. They became a screaming mob if left by themselves. The minute you departed the schoolyard, you began priming them for what they were going to see. You had them look out the window and see some things on the way, and you murdered them if they made any noise. After you got them out there, you turned the motor off and said, "All right, nobody's going to say anything, not even move a foot, for 5 minutes." And having primed them beforehand, you only had to stop for 1 minute. The birds were all singing right in view. Another important thing was to talk at different levels. Even with a class of sixth graders, there was everyone from the mentally challenged to the bright lights in the class, who were mostly troublemakers because they were bored. You had to find something for each of these people. What I did was start with everyone looking at an insect or a spider. I had it crawl around on me. Some people were shocked that I would let an insect do this, but they began not only to see what I was trying to tell them, but also to learn to be respectful toward all life. Ethics were taught by inference. I've also incorporated a little P.T. Barnum in doing things. I was at Corkscrew Swamp in southern Florida once, and it was time for closing. Here came a couple of college kids who didn't know what to do with themselves. They found a mother alligator and her young, and they started badgering her and making her hiss at them. At the time, a stork was performing his fantastic feeding dance. He dabbled a pink foot under a lily pad to attract fish, and then he'd put his beak in the water, snap them into his pouch, and try again. To get the kids' attention, I yelled, "Look at this fantastic thing going on over here." I was all alone and felt a little foolish yelling in the middle of this silence, but I had to entice them. I had enough experience in the school forest to know that teenagers sometimes will respond to somebody who is showing some authority yet acting a bit. So I went into a spiel about how what this bird was doing was wonderful, but they didn't listen. So I repeated it a second time. Finally, one of them looked over and I said, "If you'll be quiet, you'll see the greatest show on earth." I told them this was something that they would never see again in their lives, a bit exaggerated, but finally they saw him perform the feeding ritual and I said, "Now here's what he's going to do," and he did, and that finally got them. They would never have seen it otherwise. They then sat transfixed for about half an hour watching this bird. They couldn't stop watching. I was lucky enough to do the right thing at the right time. I've had a lot of failures. Once in a while, you hit the right things to do, and it works. I'll have more about Jim Zimmerman in an upcoming Natural Wonders program. I also wanted to try some gentle persuasion in hopes that it will be enlightening for you and cause a change in how you look at harvesting ramps this spring. Wild onions, wild lakes, people call them all kinds of things. I spent 2 months in Costa Rica in the early 70s and was lucky to have Peace Corps volunteer friends who showed us around many parts of the beautiful country. We had a wonderful time. But one of the disturbing things we learned when we enjoyed a beer at a bar was that people loved to down sea turtle eggs with their drinks. Turtle eggs were available in all the bars. Those who harvested the eggs said that they only took a small portion of any turtle nest they dug up along the beaches. They believed they were doing no harm to the turtles. The obvious problem with this is that the next person who came along and dug up the nest of eggs at the beach would reason that they were only taking a small amount, and the next person would rationalize that same thing until few or no eggs were left to hatch. Thank goodness today most turtle arribada beaches in Central America are protected by people who understand and love the ocean-going turtles. The same outlook exists for those who love to harvest ramps on our hillside forests in spring. We think we're only taking a small number of ramps, and we think our actions couldn't possibly have an impact on the general population. But others will follow you to that same patch and harvest what they only think is a small amount. And more will follow after that, thinking their digging is having no impact on the plants. In spring, ramps haven't yet produced flowers and then seeds. Thus, we're making their reproduction impossible and diminishing their numbers and abundance. A salient point is that it's illegal to harvest any native plants from public lands. And if you're a landowner, I hope you'll be sensitive to your native plant populations and the impact any harvesting is doing to them. Remember, we're only borrowing our land from future generations. There's no sustainable harvesting of ramps. We have plenty of sources of good onion family foods. Please use those and let the ramps continue to grow and even expand their numbers. Our forest biodiversity depends on people understanding the impact we have. And my botanist friends tell me that clipping the leaves, if you must have some, doesn't kill them. And leaves have lots of flavor for your cooking. So thank you for listening. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders.